Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the club, the Psychology Forum. My name is Patrick O'Reilly. I am delighted beyond measure to introduce our speaker for tonight. Dr. Eugenie C. Scott is the former executive director of the National Center for Science Education, Incorporated, a not-for-profit membership organization of scientists, teachers, and others that work to improve the teaching of science as a way of knowing, the teaching of evolution, and the teaching of climate change. A former college professor, Dr. Scott is an internationally known expert on the creationism and evolution controversy and is called upon by the press and other media to explain science to the general public. She is the author of Evolution versus Creationism and an Introduction and co-editor with Glenn Branch of Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our School. Dr. Scott is the recipient of numerous awards from scientists and educators and has been awarded 9 honorary degrees. Additionally, she is the president of Bay Area Skeptics, a science education organization here in the Bay Area, which is now well into its third decade. So please welcome Dr. Scott.
Well, good evening. It's very, very marvelous to be here at the Commonwealth Club. This is an organization that I have a great deal of respect for, and it's really quite an honor to be asked to speak. So I'm going to talk about why do people reject good science. You know, when scientists and members of the general public are asked about evolution, the differences are striking. In this Pew Foundation survey conducted in late 2014, 98% of scientists accept human evolution, but only 65% of the general public do. This survey, by the way, was conducted on members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS is the largest organization of science professionals in the world. The British BAAS is always a little annoyed when we point that out, but you know, they're older, we're bigger. But it's a very good sample to use for comparisons like this because it includes scientists from all scientific disciplines, social sciences, natural sciences, as well as engineering. So the sample was drawn to be broadly representative of American scientists. When scientists and... Sorry. Oh, this is not a touchscreen. Hang on, I'm spoiled. The same thing is true of climate change, particularly anthropogenic climate change. Scientists show much higher levels of acceptance than the general public. In this same Pew Foundation poll, 87% of AAAS scientists think that global warming is due to human activity, but only 50% of the general public do. In fact, there are a lot of topics where scientists differ considerably from the general public, not just evolution and climate change, but GMOs and vaccinations, although, interestingly enough, scientists and the general public are much closer together on their acceptance that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is safe. But when you look around, there seem to be a lot of topics where it seems that evidence really doesn't count for very much. It's tempting to look at some of this craziness, plus the differences between scientists and the public that I was talking about, and conclude that we are living in a particularly anti-intellectual time, or that we are living in a particularly anti-scientific time. I take a contrary view. We are supposed to be empiricists in science, so what is the evidence that Americans are anti-science? Other than anecdote, and after all, the plural of anecdote is not evidence, as we know, I don't see much evidence that there is some sort of wholesale rejection of science going on. On the contrary, there is much evidence against it. Surveys for years have overwhelmingly shown that Americans are very pro-science. This same Pew survey showing the disconnect between scientists and the general public on issues like evolution and climate showed that most scientists actually really like science. They think science makes life easier and has a positive effect on healthcare, the food supply, and the environment. In these Pew data, over half of Americans think the United States scientific achievements and medicine are the best in the world or above average. In this 2014 Harris Poll on Occupations and Prestige, and apologies because it's obviously really tiny, tiny print. Those of you listening to this on a podcast won't care, but people here are kind of going, squint. But science is number four. That's right up there with doctors, firemen, and the military. It's essentially tied for second or third place. Science is considered quite prestigious. Perhaps even more revealing, when people are asked, what occupation would you want your child to pursue? Scientists are right up there with doctors and engineers, number three. So there doesn't seem to be a big anti-science sentiment in the American public. Minimally, it's nuance, which actually I think bodes well for science and efforts to improve the public understanding of science. What we do see is people are anti this science, or they are anti that science. But science in general, science per se, is something that people are really enthusiastic about. So maybe when we think about science in the public, we should be asking, why are certain sciences rejected and not others? Now, we do have some data on the public understanding of science from a variety of institutions that have conducted survey on these matters. They tell us about the content knowledge of our fellow citizens, and you know, Americans tend to rank in about the middle of science knowledge among comparisons of citizens of other nations. But maybe one of the reasons why Americans reject this science or that science has to do with a lack of understanding of how science is done. Lack of understanding or full understanding of the methodology or, if you will, the philosophy of science. Now, the science and engineering indicators provide some insight into this question. The SEI are produced by the National Science Board, which is a component of the National Science Foundation. And you can get these online. It's great. They're free. They have lots and lots of statistics in them. And they're conducted every 2 years. The 2014 data are presented. I'm having trouble finding where things are on this screen. Oh, well, we'll just forge right on ahead. In every survey, the science and engineering indicators asks questions about how science works, including some open-ended ones. Notice how very cleverly I covered that up so you're not reading it. You are all a bunch of smart people. You are all trying to read that tiny little print. And I don't want you to read that print. I want you to listen because I'll tell you everything you need to know. How's that? So one question that they ask people when they do these surveys is, you want to test the efficacy of a blood pressure drug. What's the best way to go about it? Is it to give the drug to 1,000 people and then come back later and see how many have decreased blood pressure? Or would you give the drug to 500 people with high blood pressure and give the drug to another 500 people with high, don't give the drug to another 500 people with high blood pressure, and then come back later and measure to see how many have lower blood pressure? Okay, it's time for the quiz. How many of you think that the first option is the best one to determine the efficacy of a blood pressure medicine? Okay, a couple of hands went up. How many think the second one is the better way to figure out? Most of the hands in this room went up. Well, congratulations, my friends, because you did better than about one-third of our fellow citizens. Only 34% of our fellow voting citizens understand the basic principle of experimental science, that you hold constant some variables while letting others vary so that you can measure the effect of some outcome. And the utterly dismal theorem here is it's actually gone down in the last few years. So Americans are generally positive about science, but they don't really know a lot about how it works. And one of the things that Americans don't seem to really understand very well is how scientists reach a consensus in their explanations of how the world works. Because what we find with things like evolution and climate change is that although there's a very strong consensus among scientists, I showed you some of the numbers there, the general public doesn't seem to be impressed by this. And I think part of this disconnect is because they really don't understand how hard it is to get to that consensus. Let's say that I have a brilliant scientific idea, I think it's brilliant. But of course, I can't just run out and tell everybody about my brilliant idea. I've got to figure out if it really does explain nature in the way that I think it does. So I've got to do some research. I've got to set up some tests. I've got to see whether my really great explanation does work. I need to see if I can engage some of my friends in testing these ideas with me. Maybe they'll run a few tests and think, you know, Jeannie, I think you got something here. Let's have a symposium at our next professional meeting so that we can maybe interest some more of our colleagues in testing Eugenie's great idea. And over time, you know, they'll tell us what's wrong with it. We'll go back and tweak and we'll sort of figure out the improvements of my great idea. And this iterative process goes on and on and on and on. And at some point we might think, okay, we've really got something here. Next step is we're going to write this up and we're going to submit it to a journal, and the journal will send it out for more peer review, and more scientists will say, well, this is a pretty good idea, but they forgot to look at this and that and this, and so, oh God, we forgot to look at those. So we'll have to go back again. This iterative process takes a long time. It is not really easy. But let's say that I really did come up with a good idea, and it's been tested, and scientists have sort of chewed on it and spit it out and run it up the flagpole and all the other cliches, and they have concluded that, yes, in fact, Eugenie has a great idea, and it goes into the scientific consensus, and it goes into the textbook. What more can I like? I would like it if this little message didn't come up to you. Are you getting a message on that? Oh, good. It's just me. Schedule maintenance complete. I don't care. That's not my computer. The caption here says, most scientists regarded the new streamlined peer review process as quite an improvement. The people laughing in this audience are probably scientists because it's pretty clear that just about anything would be better than the procedure that we do have, which is pretty grim for testing and getting ideas into the scientific consensus. Just for fun, how many scientists are in this audience? There's usually a few. Yes, okay, now, don't worry, I'm not going to call on you. Keep your hands up. Keep your hands up. All scientists, confess, all of you who are scientists, okay. Those of you with your hands up, keep them up. All right. Those of you with your hands up, how many of you have ever submitted a professional paper? Keep your hands up. Okay. Those of you who have ever submitted a professional paper, and that's most of the people whose hands were originally raised, keep your hand up if every single paper you've ever submitted has been published. I am impressed, madam. She's only got one paper. Okay. We'll come back in 10 years. Okay. And all of the hands, except this one, all of the hands went down, and everybody laughed because, of course, that's exactly what happens. Nobody promises you a rose garden when it comes to science. It's a lot of hard work, and sometimes you fail. In fact, most of the time you fail. So maybe part of the problem with rejecting this science or that science is that people really lack the understanding about the process of science. We tell people that 97% of climate scientists agree that CO2 is a warming gas and its increase from human sources is producing a startlingly high rate of global warming, and they shrug. Maybe they don't understand how difficult it is to come to a consensus among scientists about some explanation of nature. Now, one meme that we do see oftentimes, unfortunately, in the public understanding of science is this idea that scientists are really just in it for the money. Yeah. Yes. You can see them leaving Wall Street in droves for that get-rich-quick of science research, right? I also think that part of the problem, indeed, is that people really don't understand what the process of building a scientific consensus involves, and that we need to do more to help people understand that process. But in addition to the methods of science, there's the content of science, and indeed, Americans aren't scoring very high. Maybe it's just that people are ignorant of the science behind, say, evolution or climate change or the safety of vaccinations. Maybe they just need to be educated. After all, there's a big difference between ignorance and stupidity. One of these is curable. So Do we have evidence that more information will change minds? Well, we definitely have evidence of people changing their minds with more information. Let me lead into this. First of all, if you ask Democrats and Republicans whether the Earth is warming, you get a very high percentage of Democrats agreeing and many fewer Republicans. In this Pew study, 88% of Democrats agreed the Earth is warming, 50% of Republicans and Independents were someplace in the middle. Now, the numbers go down a little bit when you add the human activity component, anthropogenic global warming, with fewer Democrats, Republicans, or Independents accepting anthropogenic global warming. But the strong difference in acceptance of human-caused global warming, depending on political party, persists, with Republicans much less likely to accept it than Democrats. So this guy really kicked the hornet's nest. Former South Carolina Republican Bob Inglis has come out for both a warming planet and believes that humans have a lot to do with it, but he didn't always hold these views. He used to be quite dismissive of climate change. He was quite critical of Al Gore's and Inconvenient Truth, for example, deriding it with fellow Republican congressmen. Inglis lost his seat in 2010 to a more conservative candidate. He was Tea Partied out of office. He had made the mistake of changing his mind about climate change. In the movie Merchants of Doubt, he relates how he accompanied a group of scientists and other politicians to Antarctica and was blown away by the evidence from ice cores, melting glaciers, and other sources that the climate is indeed changing. It's a very moving scene if you've ever seen Merchants of Doubt. If you don't get it from Netflix, I think it's on Netflix now. It's a very, very interesting movie about science denial, really. He also reported in interviews that his family also pushed him to accept climate change. He has written, "My oldest was voting for the first time when I ran again in 2004, and he said, 'Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to have to clean up your act on the environment.' And so I had this new constituency, my son, my four daughters, my wife, all feeling the same way." Michael Shermer, president of the Skeptical Society and editor of Skeptic Magazine, also claims a turnaround in his opinion about climate change. He also writes the Skeptic column for Scientific American, which some of you may read. In a column he wrote in 2006 for Scientific American, he writes that he rejected global warming because he had a long-standing general rejection of the environmental movement. He writes in an expanded essay in 2008, "Later that month, I attended a TED conference where former President Al Gore delivered the finest summation of the evidence for global warming I have ever heard, based on the 2006 documentary film about his work, An Inconvenient Truth. Because we are primates with such visually dominant sensory systems, we need to see the evidence to believe it, and the striking visuals of countless graphs and charts, and especially before and after photographs showing the disappearance of glaciers around the world, shocked me viscerally and knocked out my skepticism." After that experience, he read a number of popular books, and which further convinced him of the truth of global warming. Third example, Richard Cizik is the former vice president of governmental affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals. He's described himself as a pro-Bush conservative, so this is not some wild radical. In an interview in 2005, he said, "I had a conversion experience on the climate issue not unlike my conversion to Christ. I was at a conference in Oxford where Sir John Houghton, an evangelical scientist, was presenting evidence of shrinking ice caps, temperatures tracked for millennia through ice core data, increasing hurricane intensity, drought patterns, and so on. I realized all at once, with sudden awe, that climate change is a phenomenon of truly biblical proportions." Now, unfortunately, in 2008, he was fired from the National Association of Evangelicals after comments he made on NPR's Fresh Air about his acceptance of gay unions and public funding of contraception, which he felt would be a way to avoid abortions. The NAE, by the way, continues to educate its members about climate change, so that hasn't actually changed. Their theology is creation care rather than dominion theology. So yes, people can change their minds. But most don't. In fact, Sometimes receiving additional scientific information on one of these controversial issues results not in changing a position, but in solidifying a position already held. Brendan Nyhan and colleagues have conducted a number of studies in which people who have strong beliefs about some topic, like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or Obama's birthplace, or vaccination, have been provided with corrective information. In the study reported in this article published in the journal Pediatrics, a sample of parents were asked questions about their attitudes toward vaccines, their trust in health institutions, and so on. Now, among the subjects, there was a full range of attitudes from the strongly anti-vaxxers to the people who were strongly in favor of vaccinations and everybody in between. Now, next, the parents were divided into four groups and given one of four fact-based messages. There was also a control that didn't get any of the vaccination-related messages. They were given something to read, because that's what a control is all about, right? You all learned about controls from the science and engineering indicators, right? So this group was given something to read about the benefits of feeding birds in your backyard or something. So science marches on. So the parents, after reading these materials, were then asked, given another follow-up questionnaire, asked about their belief that vaccines cause autism, whether they believe the measles, mumps, rubella, the MMR vaccine, causes serious side effects, and about their intent to vaccinate children. So there were basically three outcomes on that. Here were the kinds of questions, here were the choices that were given. The autism correction question, which was given to a quarter of the sample, was just factual information about how the supposed Wakefield link between autism and vaccination was really not supported by science. It was bogus. It was a very thorough debunking of that point of view. Science stuff, in other words. They had another science-related one, which they called disease risks, in which they talked about the dangers of diseases if children get measles or mumps or something. In other words, more science stuff. And then they had a couple of emotional questions. They showed pictures of kids with diseases, and boy, these pictures would really touch your heart. You cannot unsee this one picture of this little toddler. He's sort of floor-to-ceiling little red spots of measles. It's just the saddest thing you've ever seen. And a disease narrative in which they read a story about a baby who got very sick after he caught measles from another child. Now, they used these because these are very similar to messages that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, was using to try to encourage vaccination. Now, what do you think? Do you think, let's do another quiz. You're really such a receptive audience here. How many of you think that the one or the other, the science-based treatments, as they say in the science biz. How many of you think one or the other of the science-based treatments was most effective in reaching kids? Anybody? Oh, you're a sober bunch today. So I've tricked you on this. How many of you think the more emotional approaches worked? Much more enthusiasm for emotion. Well, actually, none of them worked very well. At least for the outcome of getting parents to say they're, yes, they will go ahead and vaccinate their kids. The autism correction story, the first one, the science-y one, at least decreased the percentage of parents who thought vaccines caused autism. That's good. So, you know, it's very easy when reading this kind of literature to fall into this trap of thinking we might as well just kiss our posteriors goodbye. There's nothing that can be done. Everything is gloom and doom. People are stupid. Nobody, you know, forget trying to educate people. No, that's not what's going on, because these kinds of empirically based, fact-based kinds of things do work. They just don't work as well as you might think they work. And there's a subset of people within these groups. There was a subset of the sample from the Nyhan study of really strong anti-vaxxers, that this not only did not work, it backfired. It made even strong, it strengthened their negative feelings toward vaccination. For this subset, hearing evidence that there wasn't any MMR autism link reinforced their conspiracy inclinations that there were, you know, folks were out to get them, as it were. Another example from the same researchers, Nyhan and Riefler, subjects were given a fake news article to read that quoted President George W. Bush making a statement that sounded very much like Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And within the article, it was followed up by a correction from a Republican source. This was a Blue Ribbon Committee, which had lots of Bush advisors in it. So, you know, it's not like the New York Times said he was wrong. It was a source that should have been attractive to the people that they were trying to reach. People who reported themselves as strongly conservative were even more likely to believe that Iraq had WMDs after reading the correction. In another study, the researchers quoted President Bush as claiming that tax cuts improved government revenue. This is being given in San Francisco, so you can imagine the chuckle coming from the audience here. Subjects were then given a correction again from that came from advisors to President Bush. This was not some sort of liberal source of a correction. These were another Blue Ribbon panel and so forth, and they found that subjects who got the correction were more likely to believe the original statement that tax cuts improve government revenue. It reinforced their initial views. Now, the takeaway here is that not everyone, but when people with strong opinions are presented with accurate information that corrects misinformation, they don't change their view. They don't always change their view. They may double down on their original positions. Why is this so? This seems to be sort of a mystery to those of us who really think logic and rationality and empirical evidence is important. And, you know, we certainly try to take that into account in our own decisions. Doesn't everyone? Well, psychologists and other social scientists have a number of concepts that attempt to explain phenomena like these. There are a lot of concepts floating around in the literature. They overlap a lot. I'm not going to try to distinguish among them. Culture of cognition, motivated reasoning, motivated cognition, confirmation bias, disconfirmation bias. Look them up. For our purposes tonight, as sort of discussing ideas informally, publicly, they all refer in some way to viewing factual information through a filter. Usually an ideological or values-laden filter. Now, I just used the I word. To some people, the word ideology is unclean. Ideology is not a dirty word, okay? I'd like to try to put in a good word for ideology, as it were. Ideologies are how we shape our lives. Our isms reflect and to some degree determine what is important to us. Each of us is a matrix of ideologies, in the best sense of this word. One can be a feminist, environmentalist, humanist. Feminism, humanism, environmentalism, all of these isms are ideologies. In fact, there's one of them as close to you as I am. They reflect the values that we consider important. We human beings are social primates. We live in groups. Groups are important to us. We identify with the people who are most similar to us in our values. We form tribes holding mutual values and interests. We embrace groups that share our ideologies. Now, some social science researchers have come up with some ideas that might help us understand this better and that also shed light on why we deny empirical information. Working with some ideas from anthropologist Mary Douglas, Daniel Kahan and colleagues at the Yale Cultural Cognition Laboratory suggest that people can be placed along two axes depending on their values. There's the individualist communitarian axis and a cross-cutting hierarchist egalitarian axis. So kind of visualize a plus with individualist and communitarian on the x-axis and hierarchist and egalitarian on the y-axis. And by the way, you can Google and find a quiz that will ask you questions that will allow you to place yourself in one of these quadrants. So I'm sure you will all go home and do exactly that. And of course, everybody has tendencies on both of these axes, just different degrees. There is a loose association with political party here. Republicans are more likely to be hierarchical and individualistic. And Democrats are more likely to be egalitarian and communitarian. Remember, these are very rough kinds of, you know, you could be closer to the center of the two axes. You know, a liberal Republican and a conservative Democrat may have more in common than certainly the extremes. Libertarians are egalitarian individualists. Yeah, and I didn't know their symbol was a porcupine either. Somehow that fits, but I digress. Now, in my opinion, evangelical Christians are good examples of hierarchist communitarians, that Northwest quadrant. Now, obviously, this is not parallel. These other three are political parties, and evangelical Christians are not political parties. But they do tend to be communitarian in the sense of social gospel and look, you are your brother's keeper. And yet they also are hierarchical in the sense that they have a, you know, God and Jesus and people and so forth. There's a hierarchical view of the great chain of being, so to speak. Again, we're social primates. We seek out those who have views like ours, whether these views arise from personality differences or environmental forces shaping us from early socialization on, or combinations of the above. We form tribes, so to speak, among those who share our values, and we feel strongly about our tribes. Therefore, information that either disrupts our relationship with our group or that threatens our values is highly distasteful and is even threatening and likely to be rejected. Remember these three guys? English, Shermer, and Sizek? Each of them changed his mind, saying that the facts, the empirical evidence, the science, made them finally accept science change. Yet if you remember the stories of how these changes came about, each of these men also experienced some emotional concomitant of this change of view. I suggest that it is extremely rare when the facts alone result in a change in a strongly held position. Inglis was under pressure from his family to be more environmentally friendly. Plus, he described being emotionally blown away by his experience in the Antarctic. Shermer talks about being viscerally shocked by an inconvenient truth. And I suspect he was also affected by a virtual buzzsaw of his fellow skeptics who were aghast that he was entertaining the likes of climate contrarian Bjorn Lomborg. I suspect Shermer had a tribal conflict. His libertarian tribe was pushing him in one direction, his science skeptic tribe was pushing him in another, and it was a complex of factors, not just the pure empirical facts, that pushed him away from being a global warming contrarian. Sizek talks about the awe he experienced in realizing the seriousness of global warming. Each of these men indeed became aware of scientific evidence for global warming, but each of them also had a profound emotional experience as part of that change. We human beings are not just logical and rational. Our emotions and beliefs are critical in determining how we interact with the world. I want to talk about evolution and climate change as examples of this principle. I used to work at the National Center for Science Education, as Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, and a number of years back we began to notice that in legislation being submitted around the country, evolution was being bundled with global warming as controversial issues. Bills were introduced that would require that teachers treat global warming and evolution differently from other science subjects. There have been over 65 of these bills over the years, only two of which have passed, though that's two too many. And these bills and other anti-science legislation continue to be introduced to this day. You can find out more about them on ncse.com. Let's start with evolution. When I'm talking about creationism tonight, I'm talking about the theological doctrine of special creationism, which is the idea that God created, but not just that God created, because all Christians believe God created. It's how God created. Not who done it, but what happened. God created in the special creationist theology everything according to its present form. So the galaxies, the planets, Earth and its relationship to the sun and everything, the plants and animals on Earth, human beings, everything was created in its present form. There has not been descent with modification. There has not been common ancestry of living things. Now, usually, in the most common form of special creationism, this creation event took place all at one time, over six 24-hour days, as in a literal interpretation of the Bible. There are young Earth creationists, old Earth creationists, and intelligent design creationists, which sort of overlap. But remember, there are many religious people who accept evolution as well as the special creationists who do not. Special creationism is not compatible with evolution, although other religious views are, can be. There are different degrees of evolution rejection. The strongest, of course, is just to deny that nothing evolves, not planets, not solar systems, not galaxies, not living things. Nothing evolves. Everything is, the universe is static. A more mild form is to accept that the physical universe has changed cumulatively over time, but not living things. A yet more nuanced view that you find among creationists is that living things that, yes, the physical universe evolved and most living things, but draw the line at human beings, sort of a human exceptionalism point of view. Now, when somebody identifies himself or herself as a creationist, you really don't know where they are without asking, because the person may be at one end or another end of this kind of continuum. And people use the term creationist very broadly. Now, like evolution, climate change rejection takes several forms. Some believe that it's not getting warmer at all, very difficult to entertain, especially within the last 5 years, which have just been very, very warm. The possibility that it is getting warmer, but humans aren't responsible, to deny the anthropogenic component of climate change. And then the third position is that it's getting warmer, people are responsible, but really we can't do anything about it. We can only accommodate rather than prevent disaster. It's kind of an interesting thing if you look at these three positions, because the first two are really scientific questions. Is it getting warm or not? That's a scientific question. Are people responsible or not? That's a scientific question. The third one, it's getting warmer, but you know, what are we going to do about it, if anything? That's a policy question. That is a question that reasonable people can disagree upon, shall we say. But it is conceptually different from the other two. The third one is really more about the consequences of climate change than about the science. And if you really look at the anti-climate change literature, this is fundamentally where people are coming from. People's concern about the consequences of climate change strongly influence their consideration of whether it is occurring. Just as the primary concern of those who doubt evolution is the consequences for their faith, if indeed evolution is valid. Now, I often hear, oh, those creationists rejecting climate change, I wish they would just shape up. There's a difference between rejecting evolution and rejecting climate change, although there's some overlap. And let me try to explain that, because it is a matter of some confusion. There's a difference between political conservatism and religious conservatism. Conservative Christians hold certain religious views. They believe in the inerrancy of the Bible. They believe in a personal relationship with Jesus for salvation. These are people who are evangelicals, fundamentalists, charismatics. They prefer the term conservative Christian, so that's the term I use. Political conservatives, on the other hand, express confidence in capitalism as an economic system. They have opposition to taxation. They believe in minimal government. They elevate individuality and personal liberty to a high state. Remember that continuum that Dan Kahan came up with? And the overlap of these two is the religious right. Those who are simultaneously religiously conservative and politically conservative. But not all political conservatives are members of the religious right. Not all conservative Christians are politically conservative. They are the social gospel Christians, for example, are politically quite liberal. Not all political conservatives are religiously conservatives. They belong to mainstream Christian denominations, or they just don't care about religion. If we look at this diagram in terms of the anti-evolution movement, and we overlay anti-evolutionism on this diagram, it's clear that most anti-evolutionists are conservative Christians, and anti-evolutionists reliably include the religious right. But because the religious right is religiously conservative, not because they're politically conservative. We actually have some very powerful allies among evangelical Christians in promoting the acceptance of evolution. And, of course, as I mentioned, not all political conservatives are anti-evolutionists. Many readily accept evolution because they belong to non-literalist religious denominations or they don't care. When a political conservative is anti-evolution, it's mostly because he or she is also a conservative Christian. In other words, a member of the religious right, not because the person is a political conservative per se. So if you know somebody is an anti-evolutionist, it's a very good prediction that they are a conservative Christian. It's not nearly as good a predictor that they are politically conservative. When you look at climate change in the same fashion, when you overlay the climate change concern, you find that the main engine for climate change denial is political conservative. Again, the religious right is reliably climate change contrarian because they are politically conservative, not because they're religiously conservative. There's not necessarily a close association between religious conservatism and anti-climate change. In fact, there is a substantial group of green Christians who are environmentalists. They favor creation care or stewardship theology rather than dominion theology, and they are outside of the anti-climate change movement. Similarly, there's been a long tradition of environmentalism within mainstream republicanism, and not all political conservatives are anti-climate change. So ideologically, climate change contrarians are politically conservative rather than religiously conservative per se. The primary motivation for those who object to climate change is political conservatism. There's one additional component to the composition of climate change contrarians, and this is an economic ideology, libertarian economics. Libertarians are a somewhat odd group politically, as they share some interests with political liberals and some with political conservatives. Like conservatives, they're strongly anti-big government. There's a very strong libertarian streak within the Tea Party, for example, and strongly support individual self-reliance. But like political liberals, they value personal autonomy, and so they support such things as legalization of marijuana, gay marriage, abortion rights, and so forth. The key characteristic of libertarianism, however, is what George Soros has called free market fundamentalism, a great confidence in the power of the free market, essentially laissez-faire capitalism. As do political conservatives, they strongly object to cap and trade or carbon tax policies or any kind of economic restraints, taxes, whatever, on the carbon-producing industries of oil, gas, and coal, in the interest of letting the free market do its thing. So there are many ideological motivations for rejecting the idea of climate change, religious, political, and economic, with the religiously motivated being the smallest part of this movement. But do remember that I'm speaking in very broad terms, and none of these movements is monolithic. I'm going to skip the next. There are a number of parallels in the way that anti-evolutionists and global warming contrarians present their cases. One is to claim that the science is still undetermined, the jury is still out, or that the science is weak. It's too soon to make a decision about warming or possible human cause. We need more data. There's too much uncertainty. Related to this is the claim that scientists on the other side are untrustworthy. There is fraud or deceit, or the opponents are bad people. Now, what it means to be a bad guy is defined differently. If you're a creationist, the bad proponents of evolution are atheists. People who don't believe in God are viewed very, very negatively in this community, as you can perhaps imagine. If you're a climate change contrarian, the bad guys are socialists or big government proponents. But again, the scientists are all sort of out to get you. For both creationists and climate change deniers, part of the rejection of the science is based on what they consider negative implications or consequences if the science is right. For creationists, they believe that if there is no God, I'm sorry, if evolution is true, there is no God. If there is no God, there's no salvation. That means you won't be reunited with your loved ones at death. You won't be reunited with God, which is sort of the goal that your whole collective values are pushing you towards. There's no moral guidance. These are horrifying kinds of consequences. So clearly the science can't possibly be correct. For global warming contrarians, if things are as dire as the warmists, as we are called, claim, then we'll have to make what they consider very unacceptable changes in their way of living. Personal freedoms will be reduced, and personal freedoms are very important in these communities. They believe that security is at risk because they believe that the military is dependent upon the carbon industries for their success. We're going to hell in a handbag. Here again, the values held by the tribe are key to understanding why the science is rejected. So the science has to be wrong. And finally, although this is not an exhaustive list, there are similarities in framing and rhetoric that I won't be talking about today. Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, "Everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not to his own facts." And it's a good point. People's opinions are different from facts. Ideas like evolution and climate change that are accepted by the scientific community are accepted because they've gone through that rigorous process of sifting and winnowing of ideas, testing and discarding the ones that don't explain nature. And finally, an agreement solidifies around an explanation and scientists move on. Heliocentrism is here to stay. And so is evolution, and so is the fact that CO2 is a warming gas and we've been pumping extraordinary amounts into it, into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. These are not opinions. Now, people should debate their opinions on those matters that certainly are matters of opinion. How to handle health care in the United States, what to do about ISIS, the problem of criminal justice, what to do about gun violence. We can think of a lot of issues that Americans have very strong opinions on. And yes, we would like to think that there is empirical information that should inform those opinions, but opinions aren't based just on facts and shouldn't be. They include values, which should be considered in making decisions about these matters of opinion. But these should not be confused with whether the Earth goes around the sun or the sun goes around the Earth. These are not opinions. But ultimately, science rejection is not about the facts. I assure you, no one shows up at the school board meeting to testify passionately against some policy about the teaching of evolution because they are so excited about the Cambrian explosion. Evolution and climate change deniers are not at all likely to change their opinions if presented only with more scientific data. Science is necessary but not sufficient. This is because denialism is rooted primarily in ideology and culture, and these are not easily changed, certainly not by heaping up more facts. There's sufficient research to suggest that people happily reject factual information if it agrees with their preconceptions or strongly held views, with their ideologies especially. Science matters, but in itself it is not sufficient. The science isn't going to be listened to if people have their fingers jammed in their ears. And what keeps the fingers jammed in the ears is the belief that something very important is going to be lost if the other guy is right. To anti-evolutionists, if evolution is true, the consequences, as I mentioned, are stupendous. You can't believe in God, you lose salvation, all this whole cascade of terrible things that happen. You lose friends, social support, and so forth. For global warming contrarians, global warming alarmists will weaken the economy, harm natural security, require compromises in individual liberty, very, very bad things. For anti-vax parents, if medical science is right and vaccines are good for your child, then I'm a bad parent. I'm putting my kid at risk. So that can't be true. Anti-vax parents, like other deniers, are making a cost-benefit evaluation. If these concerns aren't assuaged, all the science in the world won't be convincing. Communication specialists tell us the best way to effect change in people who reject the scientific view of these controversial issues is to provide effective messages. What is an effective message will differ depending on the person's reason for rejection. A very common belief that many conservative Christians have is you have to choose between faith and science. We're empiricists. This is simply empirically false. There are many scientists who are people of faith. There are many people of faith who embrace science, who embrace evolution. And the idea that you have to choose between science and faith is simply empirically wrong. So an effective message about evolution would be to assuage the concern that evolution means you can't believe in God. And there's a variety of ways of doing this, which I won't go into tonight. NCSE.com has some insight here. Another effective message about evolution is to assuage a parent's concern that their child's religious beliefs are not being ridiculed or that the teacher is not trying to change the student's religious views, because this meme is out there, and parents often are very worried about this. In climate change, again, the message needs to consider the reason for the person's rejection. You need to assuage the fear of big government and socialist takeover for libertarians and political conservatives. Encourage market forces. Bob Inglis, by the way, is for a staunch conservative Republican. He's for a carbon tax. Who knew? Vaccination. Why is the parent reluctant to get the shot? Well, data from Marin County show that the main reason why people ask for an exemption from inoculation is they think children get too many shots too close together. They don't like the schedule. The kid will gradually get all the shots, but the parent wants to do it over a much longer period of time. And the shot schedule is a bit daunting. If you've ever looked at the recommended schedule from birth to 15 months, it's a lot of stuff that's going on. And then it starts all over again from 18 months to 18 years. This is not totally irrational when people have these feelings. The message also has to come from a trusted messenger. And the most trusted messenger are those who are most like the person you're talking to. This is why evangelicals who accept evolution and Republicans and libertarians who accept climate change are so vital. They have the trust of the deniers. For anti-vax parents, other parents are people that they trust. The idea is that someone like yourself can speak the same language, has the same values and concerns. You know, it's funny, a friend told me the other day that he got into discussion about GMOs with an acquaintance and was not making headway at all. He would provide responses to all of the anti-GMO guys' claims, and, well, actually, that's not true, this is happening, that's happening. Finally, the anti-GMO guy said, "Oh, you libertarians all think alike." And the guy said, "Libertarian? I'm a socialist." This changed the entire atmosphere of the conversation. The anti-GMO guy started to listen. My friend described it as, because I was like him, maybe I was saying something that should be listened to. A trusted messenger. Finally, communication specialists tell us that messages need to be repeated often before they are absorbed. I often remind my friends and colleagues that no one ever changed somebody's mind in one pass. The best you can hope for when you're having a conversation with somebody who denies some consensus view of science is to just crack the door a little bit. That should be enough. The next time that person hears that same or a related message, maybe the door will be cracked open a little bit wider. That would be considered success. And in fact, there is research that shows that an idea such as the lack of WMDs in Iraq that is repeated very often in the news eventually gets accepted, or at least more people will accept it. What about the methodology that you use? Okay, this cartoon says, "Are you coming to bed?" "I can't. This is important." "What? Someone is wrong on the internet." A strategy you can pretty much be assured isn't going to change minds is what a lot of people do on internet forums, which is hammer away at someone until they go away in frustration. The hammerer thus believes he has won. But what's the goal? If the goal is to change someone's mind, that goal isn't going to be reached in this way. And there's an ego thing involved with a lot of people. Some internet debaters are just ornery and take on creationists or climate change deniers because it just makes them feel good to, as they put it, pound that fool into the ground. Might make you feel good, but you shouldn't confuse that with actually making progress in changing someone's mind. A whack to the shins with a 2x4 is rarely persuasive. What ultimately is going to turn the tide of science rejection, in my view, is something extremely low-tech. People have to talk to one another. Trusted messengers are listened to. The most trusted are people from the same tribe. I'm a humanist. I have dealt in my vast majority of my professional life with conservative Christians. I have a level of trust among evangelical Christians that I have built up over the years because I treat them respectfully and I listen to their concerns. People have to build up relationships of trust. That requires mutual respect. Because somebody disagrees with you does not make that person an enemy. It makes them an opponent. And there's a difference. Mutual respect occurs when people get to know one another as individuals rather than as symbols. If you can establish trustful relationships and assuage the concerns about consequences, then there is the possibility that you can move forward. And the science has a chance to be listened to. I, for one, believe that if the science is given a chance, it is persuasive. But science in itself is necessary, but not sufficient. You have to deal with all of these other ways of getting the fingers out of the ears. And then the science can work its magic. May I suggest that you go to ncse.com, the website of the National Center for Science Education, my former employer. You can subscribe for a free electronic newsletter that comes out every Friday and is really depressing. There's some wonderful writing going on in the NCSE blog. I would certainly encourage you to check that out. If you go to the news page, you'll be taken to a page that is yet more depressing. You can search by state or by year and find all kinds of interesting and useful information. And it's a membership organization, so please do consider following the donate button and join NCSE and support it. There's a YouTube site and a Facebook page. Please do check out these two resources as well. There's lots of good information about science denial, public understanding of science, the creation and evolution issue, science education, the controversy over the teaching of climate change, a whole bunch of really interesting things. My former colleagues are really wonderful sources of lots of good and interesting information. And thank you for inviting me to the Commonwealth Club and being such a very receptive audience, even if I did make you vote too often. Thanks.
Incidentally, if you don't belong to the Commonwealth Club, I recommend you join that along with NCSE. I belong to both wonderful organizations. So,
he's also a member of Bay Area Skeptics.
And that
he's a threefer. There we go. Here. Yes, sir.
Don't you think science creates a little bit of its own problem because with studies, as you publish a study, let's say that it invalidates all previous studies on that topic. We don't go back and studies as invalid. So if you're discussing the topic with someone and present a study, they'll feed those previous 10 invalidated studies back to you and say, no, look, this study says this, this study says that.
In case you didn't hear, and people who listen to this on the podcast probably won't, it was a very good question about science changes its mind all the time, and then people can bring up the previous studies that said A, whereas the new study says B. I think what's really useful a useful way to think about the content of science is to think in terms, the content, which is the explanations, theories, laws, etc., how we think science works. Think of it in terms of three concentric circles. The middle circle are the core ideas of science. You're not going to find articles saying, gee, we were wrong about heliocentrism. The planets really go around Earth after all. We don't have to worry about those guys. The next concentric circle, and by the way, people listening to the podcast are at no disadvantage because people in the audience are just seeing me wave my hands around. The next concentric circle out are the frontier ideas of science, and this is where that sort of research is going on. You expect to find changes in understandings. But you don't expect to find really wholesale changes in the basic ideas of science. That living things have common ancestors is the core idea of evolution. It is really, really strongly supported. Nobody really argues about that. What you find is people arguing about what's the relationship between birds and dinosaurs and crocodiles or something. And that's perfectly fine. And I mentioned early in the talk that one of the really useful things is if we can help the public understand how science works. And one element of how science works is that it's okay to say, I don't know, and it's okay to say, I was wrong, because both of those things are part of science. You know, science is really not what you learn in seventh grade. It's not this algorithm that you follow, and at the end, you come up with the right answer. It's not a recipe. It's more like, you know, two steps forward, a step to the side, a step back, maybe a lurch forward. Eventually, we get to a better understanding of nature. But it is. And the point that you're making about how opponents of your whatever view you're holding can go back to that older literature and say, but... You said that Archaeopteryx really wasn't a flying animal or something else. So you just have to kind of cope with that. Let me read one from somebody who wrote it down. In the past 25 years, has there been a significant increase in the percentage of college graduates with science degrees versus liberal arts graduates? Oh, I should read these before I read them out loud. I'm sorry, whoever wrote that question, I really don't know. But the science and engineering indicators would have that information. So please go ahead. How would you suggest that an ordinary non-scientist person, those are the ordinary people, can further science education, maybe as a donor or volunteer? You know, there are great needs, especially at the elementary school level, for people to help teachers with science education. The new science education standards in the state of California, and in fact in most states now, especially if they have adopted the next generation science standards, require more hands-on, minds-on, inquiry-based science education rather than memorize the list of terms, which is how too many of us were force-fed science. And what teachers will often very much appreciate is some help with the logistics, so to speak. If you're going to have a demonstration for some fourth graders, it helps to have somebody to set it up and to take it down. So I would just go to your local PTA and volunteer to teachers in the school and see who can use your talents. I think it would be a very useful thing to do. Yes.
Exploratorium.
And the Exploratorium could use volunteers as well, and that's a place that deals with teachers a whole lot. Thank you very much for that suggestion. Sir. That'd be pretty good. That doesn't mean that you should license that drug immediately. You'd want to test it a little bit more than that. But yeah, I mean, a lot of times those kinds of discoveries are tested on small samples, and this is that iterative process that science is famous for. You know, keep working at it. The good stuff will fall through the filter, so to speak. The chaff will be kept in the screen. Or is it the other way around? Yes. You know, I'm going to encourage you to contact my NCSE colleagues because they would be more appropriate to answer that question. I've been retired for a year. NCSE is going in somewhat different directions, and it would be better for you to contact them. They know more about what's going on right now at the office. I'm afraid we've come to the end of our time. Again, thank you very much for coming out on this really quite beautiful day. And coming to hear me at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you again.